Bet the Board in conjunction with NASCAR presents Stay Green. Stay Green is your first stop for all the metrics, matchups, and money-making opportunities at the track each race week. This is Stay Green, the NASCAR betting podcast. Here are your hosts, Todd Furman and racing analyst Chris Wormy.
Welcome into the Stay Green podcast, a Bet the Board production in conjunction with NASCAR as the Cup Series heads to the Irish Hills of Michigan in the wake of what was a very interesting race last week in Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by racing analyst Chris Worm. And Wormy, when we talk about what we saw in Indianapolis, we're obviously going to get to the full breakdown. We have plenty of ground to cover. What if you could describe what you saw unfold last Sunday in one word, what would it be?
Oh, man. I would say debacle. I thought it was kind of a debacle. I was just trying to think like something from a movie, you know, when in Gladiator, he's like, are you not entertained? And it was like, I'm not entertained. Oh, now I'm too entertained. This just turned into kind of a nightmare finish. I'm ultimately really happy that Reddick was able to pull off the win. So I think that the right guy won the race, and I think that's good.
Yeah, that's the most important part. If we have one silver lining, that the best driver throughout the course of the race was able to grab the checkered flag. And Tyler Reddick, over the last couple of weeks, really asserting himself as a road course ringer. We'll get to Reddick and how we think you should rate him going forward, especially with Watkins Glen looming on the horizon. But before we do all that, I want to encourage you guys to follow Chris on Twitter. That's at Chris, C-H-R-I-S, Wormy, W-E-R-M-E-1-5. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And again, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod, and maybe most importantly, follow the podcast because Wormy's been red hot giving out race day winners. The podcast get a little Austin Cindric top five, followed it up with AJ Allmendinger coming in with a top 10 finish. So for all those folks looking for investments each and every week, we update the website on Sunday mornings, tweet it all out for you on social media, and want you guys to be able to take advantage of the betting market there, especially with football season looming on the horizon. And Chris, if we hit the Wayback Machine and go back to Sunday's race, we continue to see a trend emerge that Kyle Larson remains the only pre-week race favorite to win a race so far in 2022. But Tyler Reddick did go off as the favorite at a lot of shops. Second career cup victory after winning at Road America. Leads a race high 38 laps. Car stayed out of trouble most of the race. He now has a fifth place finish at COTA, 35th at Sonoma, obviously the throwaway. First at Road America, first at Indy. What have you seen from the eight in the wake of controversy and a very interesting post-race interview with Mr. Childress himself to try and gauge Tyler Reddick and how you're assessing him going forward?
Well, I mean, he's a road course ringer. We love to throw that term around, and I think it's time we throw it around with him. I mean, he's by far been the best on road courses this year. And, you know, even, you know, the one throwaway, he's been great in practice. He's been great in qualifying, and he's raced well. Like, he is very predictable on these road courses. And as a gambler, as someone that's, you know, trying to make money doing this, you want to have someone that's predictable. And he's just been that. I think, you know, we were kind of talking before the show, we could see him open as the favorite at Watkins Glen. I still give Chase the edge as you just look at the body of work at road courses in general over the last few years. And but also that team, that's a championship team right now. That's a championship team. We'll get it more into him later, but I would say you still make Chase the favorite, you know, maybe between 4 and 5 to 1, and you're going to see you have to make Reddit either a co-favorite or the second favorite.
It's incredible. I mean, when you talk about a guy who openly said that he didn't like road course racing in the past, I give him a world of credit for honing his skills there, and he's really become a dominant force with the next-gen car, especially in this dynamic. And to your point, I do think you're going to see Chase open as a modest favorite. Would it shock me if Tyler Reddick opened right alongside him? Not at all. But as far as a head-to-head matchup is concerned, you open that thing up at Pick'em, and you let professional bettors steer the betting market more so than tipping your hand as an odds maker, given what we've seen from the 8 and the 9 as far as their ability to have race-winning cars week in, week out, especially when we're making left and right turns. I do want to get into the track layout itself. Obviously, it's come under a bit of fire. We saw Denny Hamlin with some strong words on social media. It seems to be a broken record when we talk about the 11 and his strong takeaways after each and every race. But we now have two data points for the road course at Indy. I don't remember last year being as tumultuous. Now, granted, you know, recency bias always does play a role. And to the field's credit, they played nice early on. But when you talk about turn one, it really started to feel like bumper cars. And for anybody that was sitting on an outright ticket, head-to-head matchups, top three, top five, top 10, every time they waved that caution and you had to go to the overtime restart, your heart had to skip a beat and you were probably able to pace a hole in your floor.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I had the Tums just sitting out. The heartburn was for real. I mean, we don't bet plate tracks because I feel like they're very unpredictable. And I like road course racing because I do think that we have an edge, and I like the predictability and the strategy, and you can have, you know, an average car on the right strategy up against a fast car on the wrong strategy. And it makes for interesting racing, gives you a dynamic that you don't see on ovals. That being said, if you're to tell me that there's going to be a caution with 10 to go at this track, I'll never bet it again. Because, I mean, you saw matchups flip from like, and I'm not, I only know kind of, I was only paying attention to what we had, but they were flipping like 10 and 12 positions on restarts, and it just turned into something that just became completely unpredictable. And I literally wrote like in my notes, don't bet this race ever again. Like, just in the moment, I was kind of shocked at the way that, and I don't even know if this is kind of just a new thing in racing. It's like, oh, we're just going to knock guys out of the way and we don't care. And you know, the way Logano drove in there on that final restart, the second to last restart, it's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, did you think that was going to work? Like, in what world does that work? So it's unpredictable. And so in the future, I might kind of step back, and I definitely wouldn't pay favorite prices that I paid, for sure.
Yeah, and we'll get into that as part of stage two. We'll talk about our race card and some of the head-to-head matchups that we took smaller positions on. Obviously, we didn't share with our listeners, but I think it's an important exercise to obviously indicate what we've learned throughout the course of the process and make all of you smarter bettors. For those of us, new to Stay Green, you're currently in the midst of stage one, where we spend our time recapping what we saw last, trying to figure out what takeaways are going to be useful and lead to profitable betting scenarios going forward. Stage two, a little bit more into the X's and O's of the betting machinations and everything we do to put together a race card. And of course, stage three, we begin to shift our focus to the upcoming race, which of course this weekend will be on the 2 Mile Oval in Brooklyn, Michigan, one of the fastest tracks that we will see in NASCAR. But turn one wasn't the only issue that we saw play out. It did lead to a very interesting late race dynamic, one so much so that I think back NASCAR's brains into a bit of a pretzel, because they didn't have a predetermined stipulation or ruling for it, and they kind of had to adjust on the fly. And of course, what I'm referencing there is Ross Chastain and Austin Dillon both electing to use the access road to avoid some of the carnage that we saw in turn one. Austin Dillon was what it was because he wasn't racing for a potential race win, but Ross Chastain finds a way to take himself from 12th to 15th or wherever he would have come out. All of a sudden, he's neck and neck with Tyler Reddick for the race win. And when you're looking at all of this unfold, I think all of us that watch this race as fans were a bit perplexed, including the folks in the booth for NBC who had no idea how to properly explain what they were seeing before their very eyes.
I mean, this is the time when I wish I had a camera on myself you know, to go back and watch what my reaction was. You know, I watched the races alone.
You said, hold on a second. You've said that to me for about 15 years of your life. You wish you had a camera on yourself because there's no bigger fan of Worm than Worm himself.
Oh my gosh. I love myself and I love a mirror. Anyway, I don't even remember what I was like. I want to know what my reaction was because I was dumbfounded. Like, okay, first of all, how did he get there? Like, you know, I was watching kind of my matchups and my guys trying to get through. Then you see one car kind of take the access road. And then I'm still kind of watching kind of the pack. I saw that Reddick looked like he had gotten clear and Syndicate had kind of, you know, kind of fallen in behind him. And then all of a sudden, like they show another angle and Chastain's leading. And the announcers had no idea what to do. They're like, oh, and Ross Chastain taking the access road and he's leading this race. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, is this happening? And I'm thinking, here's my thought process was, there's no way NASCAR is going to let him win this race. Like, no way. However, like, I'll get to the fact where I don't think he was that wrong. But in the moment, I was dumbfounded. It is so hard to win at this level. And Tyler Reddick has had wins taken away from him in the worst ways. And I'm not even saying that Chastain would have wrecked him. I mean, he could have. I wouldn't put it past Chastain. He was just racing the leaders like he was Ryan Newman a lap down and trying to affect the outcome of a race. And I was shocked and I was really, really pissed off in the moment. And I didn't have, a dog in the fight. But just as a race fan, it's like, how is this happening? So I was really upset at first. And I, you know, went on this little no-brain Chastain, you know, type rant in the post-race poll that I did. But I'm learning now that there were a few people that weren't penalized when they did that. And so now I kind of have to take it with a little bit of I don't blame him. I don't blame him for that position, but you have to be smarter than that. Like, you really think they're going to let you pick up 15 spots on the last restart of the race? It just goes into the whole, I'm not interested in betting this race in the future.
Well, I think NASCAR obviously now is backed into a corner. They're going to have to figure out exactly what that penalty is going to be, regardless of if it happens on lap one or lap 82 in this kind of situation. I think the penalty has to be consistent. Should it be a stop and go? Should it be 30 seconds? I'll leave that to the powers that be as far as the Racing Competition Committee to figure all of that out. But what I think is interesting is you saw some drivers do that in the Xfinity race. There was no penalty. Now, it didn't impact the outcome. But to your point, I mean, if Ross Chastain and Tyler wreck each other up front, you know, how pissed off are you if you're the eight, knowing that there wasn't clarification, you did nothing wrong in this particular spot? And quite frankly, Ross Chastain thought he had a loophole, thought he was able to try and take advantage, and that scenario gave him a better opportunity, at least on the surface, to have a good finish compared to where he would have been going six wide into turn one. And I found it interesting too, because Denny Hamlin actually commented on it on the Door Bumper Clear podcast earlier this week, and he said, you know what, I was glad that those guys did it first because we had thought about it, we had discussed it, and we weren't exactly sure how all of it was going to unfold. To Denny's credit, he had a light sense of humor, and he said he probably would have missed that corner too, like he did every other corner on the road course all weekend long. But I think, you know, it's a credit sometimes to thinking outside the box, and we criticize crew chiefs, we criticize the guys in the shops trying to find that competitive edge. Chastain wasn't going to win that race straight up, so you have a couple wins banked, you may as well go out there and try and take advantage of it. We know NASCAR is going to rectify that situation should we race on the road course at Indianapolis next year. When you're talking about some of the other drivers that had good races, two that really stood out, Ryan Blaney continuing to look for that elusive first win. We know he has the non-points winning race in the All-Star race at Texas. Christopher Bell was very good. Both those drivers tied for the second most laps led with 17. But when you look at Blaney, he got into a dust up of his own with Daniel Suarez. I don't know if that's frustration. Clearly he has a chance to point himself in, but we know the pressure has to continue to be ratcheting up for the 12 if we find two more race winners over the next 4 weeks.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting race for that 12 team. I want to give them a lot of credit because we've been saying this entire year that the 12 struggles in traffic. And so what they did is they just put them out front And yeah, he had way worse tires, but tire wear wasn't really an issue. I applaud them. They gave Blaney the best chance to win that race. And they also put him in the best spot to score points. And points is something that he needs. So I think that, you know, you see when you have, whenever you have low tire wear tracks, someone is going to take that risk and forego tires one more level than even someone that's not taking tires. And you saw that this week with Blaney, and it worked out well. It was the only chance he had at winning the race when it came to speed. I just think that that eight car was so good that no one was going to beat him. And so I applaud that 12 team for saying, hey, we need to keep our guy out front. And if that means he's going to have, you know, older tires, that's fine.
Yeah, the 12 strategy with tires in the Cup race played out significantly better than Ferrari's strategy with tires in the F1 race earlier in the day at Hungary. So credit to Ryan Blaney and company trying to do what they could to get that elusive first win. Of course, it didn't quite come to fruition, but still plenty of great opportunities coming up in the next couple of weeks. The other big thing for me, Worm, when we talk about a youth movement in NASCAR and how difficult these next-gen cars can be to drive, we saw three rookies finish second through fourth, the first time since 1994 that happened, with improbable runs from, you know, Todd Gilliland, Harrison Burton up there avoiding the carnage. Austin Cindric, we expected to have a good car. He was able to deliver, finishing second, despite his post-race comments saying he didn't feel like they had a top five car, that they probably should have been running 10th to 12th. The one young driver who odds makers really respected in the betting market, we saw him take money, but there was a pretty telling comment earlier in the week about how the 14 might run. And quite frankly, he lived up to what he said. He more or less went off at a short price as a favorite in matchups, but went out there looking to race for points more so than the checkered flag.
Yeah, this was, by the way, I think you had a great comment. You texted me after the race and you said something like, this looks like an Xfinity finish, right? With Gilliland and Cindric and some of those younger guys.
And I meant no disrespect to any of the drivers, but it's rare to see guys that don't have the pedigree finishing in the top five in a Cup race, as plenty of odds makers will tell you, given the astronomical prices that were offered on those guys, even to finish inside the top 10.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that they were, you know, great all, they weren't great all race, but they finished well. And obviously that's important in this sport. So, you know, I thought it was impressive. I said in kind of the pre-race poll that I do every week before the race was, it was like we have children leading us to the green flag. And then when you saw the finish, it was almost like we had grandchildren that were up there finishing in the top five. And I just, hey, it was great for those guys to, because you have to run a clean race. It's not easy to get through that turn one for anybody. And to see those guys come out with a big, a good finish was, you know, my hat's off to them.
And the same, I guess, can be said for Bubba Wallace, who finds himself with his best career road course finish. A guy whose very own crew chief more or less said, we don't expect Bubba to run inside the top 10 on road courses, but when you could be the beneficiary of all the carnage happening in front of you, you see some disparate results. But again, a friendly reminder for those folks who would just look at the order of finish, not exactly indicative of how that race played out. Plenty of drivers that had top five cars throughout the day got shuffled back in the field, and you saw a lot of folks be able to have a much better finish than where they ran throughout the course of Sunday's race. We'll wave the white flag with one to go on stage one. I want to give you the opportunity to highlight any of the other things or major takeaways that you saw unfold on Sunday that we may not have had a chance to hit on just yet.
I guess I would just say let's bring back the old Brickyard. That's my takeaway.
That's honestly something I never thought would come out of your mouth.
I know.
Because I knew historically and traditionally it's a track that you didn't like to bet because you felt that it didn't provide some of the opportunities with low tire wear and it raced a little bit more like a plate race than anything else.
I'd rather have that than, because here's what would happen is I would look at lap times in this road course like next year and go, oh, well, I think this guy's bettable, you know, and then I'd find myself making wagers on this track and I don't want to do that again. So just bring me back the oval. You know, there's a lot that goes with that track, and kissing the bricks means something completely different, I think, when you're racing on the oval versus the road course.
And we'll, of course, get a better indication of what NASCAR's thoughts are on that when they announce the 2023 Cup schedule, hopefully sometime here over the course of the next month, in terms of us going back to the more traditional layout there, or if they'll return to Indianapolis and race the road course for the third straight year. Want to remind all of you to follow Chris on Twitter. That's at Chris Wermy, ChrisWerme. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And again, most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod for Sunday's best bets that we share on social media. And before we get into what we have planned for stage two, I guess it's as good time as any to make an announcement that Stay Green will be on the move. Not this weekend at Michigan, but in 2 weeks, you and I will take our smiley faces and we will be at the track for the Richmond Cup race and most likely for the truck race as well on Saturday night. So encourage all of you folks who may have been listening to the podcast, just finding us or happen to live in that area, to let us know, come on down to the track. We'd love to talk to a lot of the loyal listeners and want to thank NASCAR for the opportunity to take us out of our respective offices on the West Coast, traveling east for what should be a great day of racing at Richmond Motor Speedway.
Yeah, I'm super excited to do this, and Richmond's a great betting track, so I'm excited. It's going to be great for a bunch of different reasons, and it'll be the first race that I've caught this year other than Phoenix, so I'm excited to make that happen.
Are we going to be able to pry you away from the laptop, or, I mean, are you going to be glued to your laptop for live betting, that you'll walk around pre-race, you'll shake hands, you'll kiss babies, and then you'll head back to where you can get the strongest Wi-Fi signal to make sure that you don't lose any live betting opportunities trackside?
Yeah, I'm not interested in having any conversations during the race. I will be in my own world. That's just something I'm used to. Just let me be when it comes to live betting.
We'll try and do what we can to walk you down pit road through the garage area, see whose Wi-Fi you can tap into, whose shoulders you're able to look over for SMT data, and try and figure out how you can create a unique edge that even you don't have access to when you're not actually at the track. But we'll remind all the folks again next week. But if anybody out there in that, you know, DMV area, or you make a normal pilgrimage to Richmond, just another incentive to come on out. We'll share some details. Hopefully you have a chance to meet a lot of you, our loyal listeners, up close and in person for what should be a great race weekend. But with stage two, as we always do, we talk a little bit about some of the betting nuances that it takes to be a successful NASCAR bettor. And last week, we of course had a unique storyline discussing some of the disqualifications for the 11 and 18, what that meant in terms of how betting shops were electing to handle that, and the stipulations that were there. But I want to revisit a topic, and I'll call it power of pricing, for a lack of a better term. You know, you and I went into last weekend, you know, didn't have a ton of matchups, but the matchups we did have, we decided to bet against one particular driver. To be extremely candid, it did not work out the way that we drew up, going 1-3 in those four matchups, but you saw some of the prices going against Ty Gibbs, and we laid a lot more favorites than we typically do. What's kind of the general thought as you approach a betting card? I never want to sit here and say you can't lay favorites or any of that kind of nonsense that circulates throughout, you know, sports betting Twitter, but as far as the Cup Series, knowing some of the variables and how tightly contested some of these matchups can be, do you typically shy away from laying big prices, knowing that a mechanical failure can work against you, a wreck as we saw last weekend, or a variety of other factors that you don't necessarily have to address for some of the more traditional stick and ball sports?
Yeah, so obviously we faded Ty Gibbs in every matchup. I mean, he was matched up against phenomenal drivers. Bowman, Byron, who else did we have? It was Bowman, it was Byron.
Byron, Harvick, and Buescher.
Harvick and Buescher. Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, why is he matched up against those guys? Is that who Kurt Busch was going to be matched up against? I mean, listen, Ty Gibbs is a good driver, okay? He is not Kurt Busch, okay? And if that 45 car has struggled on road courses this year with Kurt Busch in it, certainly what's going to have Ty Gibbs struggle in it. Now, we did lay bigger prices, but I was just kind of saying to myself, if these guys just stay out of trouble, then they're going to beat Ty Gibbs. And
yes, the important caveat in NASCAR, if they just stay out of trouble, we're going to be okay.
And then, you know, you watching the race, all of a sudden they go bet, they show Bowman and Harvick like trying to wreck each other. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Like, you guys, I paid like minus 150 and minus 170 for you guys to beat a kid that's running in the 45 car. And you guys just, you couldn't do it. Like, Harvick was trying to wreck Bowman. And at this point, I got my hand in my face. I'm just face palming. And was really just like, well, this is why you don't lay huge favorites. And so here's what I learned. I was wrong to fade him like that at that track. If I could go back, I would say it's not wise to pay heavy juice at that track because it is such of a crapshoot if there's a late caution. So I got that wrong. And, you know, it got to the point where now I don't even know that I want to bet that race next year, let alone, you know, lay minus 170. The other thing, though, is there was an interesting matchup where Truex was 3-1 to beat Briscoe. And
incredible, by the way. You and I were texting about it, and we went, man, you don't see drivers of this caliber with that particular price. That's more Xfinity. That is a bad head-to-head matchup early in the week, and one guy ends up driving a jalopy, and one guy's driving a rocket ship.
Yeah. Listen, and it didn't even open there. It opened at like plus 250. And so someone thought that there was value on Chase Briscoe at minus 320 for it to get out to 3-1. Who did that? Who thought that, oh, Briscoe has a rocket ship, he's going to destroy Truex? I mean, Martin Truex Jr. is still a really good race car driver. And Chase Briscoe, he was good there last year, and he qualified well, and he ran well in the Xfinity race. His career is nothing like Martin Truex Jr.'s. It's not even close. I'll tell you this. If you give me Truex at 3-1 against anybody at any track, I'll take it. That's like a new rule. You give me 3-1 on Truex in a matchup versus any driver at any track, and you're going to take it. And fortunately, we were able to get down on that and at least got me out of there pretty close to even. And I was thrilled and excited to come to a track in Michigan where we've had success in the past with a few outrights.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild when you look at the prices. And obviously, the number one thing when you're trying to handicap head-to-heads, and this is going to sound as simplistic as possible, you want to bet the faster car. That is the goal that comes along with it. But when you watch the betting market reflect that, there was a reason that odds makers felt comfortable making Chase such a heavy favorite. To your point, I was as surprised as you that we saw the initial move come in driving that number even further. But there is more than just looking at some of the practice times. There is a little bit of art form. There's nuance. There's a lot of things that have to go into that handicapping equation before you arrive at an investment. And look, I see it all the time in other sports where guys want to bet math models. They're more than happy to, you know, take a huge look at the board. They want to play their 2 to 3% edge. And I tip my hat to them. For us, we take a little bit more of, I would say, a sniper approach where you're trying to pick off a couple of matchups where you feel you have a larger edge that you can exploit. But price, and we'll continue to talk about until we're blue in the head, blue in the face, I should say, is the ultimate equalizer. And so when you're looking at some of these matchups in a sport where so many things can go wrong, I don't think any of us anticipated the chaos and carnage coming through turn one, but just a variety of factors there. And then layer in the fact that Chase openly referenced that they could be racing for points. It made sense for an investment. And of course, you're not going to have a chance to cash 3-1 all that often. But that's a matchup, to your point, when you're getting a driver of that caliber in good equipment, that's going to be able to win his head-to-head matchup more than what the implied probability of the price says. And I think that's one of the things that you look at NASCAR as much as anything else. When you're trying to figure out prices, especially in the outright market, you're not going to always cash 7s-1s and 10-1s. You bet a driver at 10-1 that you think should be priced 7-1. You stay away from a driver at 5-1 that you think should be priced at 7-1. And it comes with time, the more you study the betting markets and as comfortable as you get. But I say all that to segue into waving the flag on stage two for the final question. Does your thought process change when you're looking at Xfinity and truck matchups, knowing that those prices can be a little bit more outlandish because there is a separation of haves and have-nots, more so than the Cup Series, where at least in the next-gen cars, I'd say there's 20 to 25 cars that are separated by the slimmest of margins?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the margins that of a Cup car are so much smaller than that of an Xfinity or a truck that, you know, a matchup that I would consider successful, you know, wins by 10 spots in the Cup Series. That rarely happens in Xfinity or trucks, right? It's maybe two or three cars between the two where you'll still see a price, and I'm willing to pay a price. If I think a guy's two or three spots better, I'll pay, you know, minus 135 or minus 140. I would never pay that in the Cup Series if I think that they're going to be within two or three positions of each other. That's just there's no value in that. So you definitely, when it comes to Xfinity and trucks, when, like I said, there's a much larger disparity between speeds of cars, a good matchup might just be two spots ahead all day. And I'm okay with that. But in the Cup Series, you definitely want to have, you know, five or six spots if you're going to be laying, you know, a minus 135 or minus 140 price.
Yeah, and the same kind of thing, I guess, you know, for folks that have explored the F1 head-to-head markets, I mean, seeing $4 and $5 favorites pretty much rinse and repeat every single weekend. In the Cup Series, where parity is why we all come back week in, week out, it's an extremely unusual circumstance, especially get a driver the caliber of the 19 matched up with a driver who's done real well at Indianapolis. We know it's his home track, but a little bit more inexperienced in that regard. I mean, Worm, you picked on me last weekend because I got my time zones confused. I feel like I have to let you read, you know, on-track activities for this weekend. So I'm going to put you on
the
spot.
You know there's zero chance I do this, right?
Yeah, I figured. Yeah, okay. I figured as much. Yeah, so I'll do this.
Okay.
You know, those of us who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, but you're here to keep me honest, and I'm more than happy to have you do that. So, all right. Nothing on track as far as Friday's concerned. It's consolidated into a relatively short Saturday and Sunday schedule at Michigan International Speedway, and the weekend will kick off with Xfinity practice and qualifying at 9:05 Eastern Saturday morning. You can see all of those events unfold on the NBC Sports app. Cup practice and qualifying, that'll be at 9:35. Eastern Pacific time, 12:35 Eastern time. That also is available on the NBC Sports app. Unfortunately, nothing on the linear TV platforms for any of those. And we'll see the Xfinity race drop the green flag at 3:30 Eastern for the New Holland 250. That's available for viewing on USA. And last, but certainly not least, the Cup race on Sunday afternoon. The Firekeepers Casino 400 is on USA. That's at 3 Eastern. Earlier in the day, though, on NASCAR Press Pass, you can see some of the NASCAR media talk to Michigan State head coaches Mel Tucker and Tom Izzo. I just want to make sure, Worm, you're going to be okay with that, being a Michigan man not rooting for Sparty in any capacity.
Oh, no. Having the little brother coaches has no bearing on whether I'll be tuning in to those pre-race stuff. I mean, if you're going to learn, I mean, Tom Izzo to me is the Kyle Busch of college basketball coaches. Like, if you just want to learn how to whine, that would be, yeah, I would look to Tom Izzo. Is that face is just an amazing whiny face. That's all I'll say about that.
Clearly endearing yourself to everybody in East Lansing. So I'm glad to hear all of that, that you let your feelings be known. And interesting that you mentioned Kyle Busch. We'll have plenty on him in Stage 3 when we look at some of the odds for this weekend in the Irish Hills. But before we kick off Stage 3, or get into the nuts and bolts, I should say, want to get into a little bit of the track breakdown. I know this has been an extremely hot topic, and as always, Worm, you will have the pulpit, you will have the ability to be on your soapbox, but you're going to have to try and contain some of your excitement and enthusiasm, at least for the next 60 to 90 seconds. Michigan International Speedway is a 2-mile moderate bank D-shaped speedway. When you're looking at it, they've been racing here in the Cup Series since 1969, very close to Ann Arbor, Detroit, 4 miles south of the village of Brooklyn in the scenic Irish Hills. It's a low tire wear speedway, 18 degrees of banking, and it's the fastest track in all of NASCAR due to its wide sweeping corners, long straightaways, and what we can only hope will be multi-groove racing without any of that plate track capabilities this weekend. NASCAR is going to use their 670 horsepower package, so it shouldn't be pack racing, but plenty of unknowns on the horizon with the tire compound in play, since it's a new one that we haven't seen as far as tire codes are concerned. And this is where I defer to you, Worm, because we always like to start our handicapping trying to figure out track comparisons. And I've heard a lot of people whose opinions I respect that have thrown Fontana into the equation or Auto Club Speedway. My gut tells me you don't quite agree with that being a data point that's at all relevant for how you're going to break down the field this weekend.
No, I'd cancel those people. Those people are canceled. It's one of those things where even people that I, you know, I really respect their opinion, sometimes they say stuff and I'm like, whoa, wait, what did you, that's what you think? I am not comparing this track at all to Fontana. The only thing that you could say is, oh, it's 2 miles. That's about it. I mean, I bet the fuel window's not even the same. Like, you run such a high horsepower at Michigan through the corners that the fuel window is going to be like smaller. Like, you'll be able to run less laps at Michigan. So even the fuel is different. So there's just not one thing other than the distance that that you can take away from anything at Fontana, in my opinion.
Yeah, don't tell that to Kyle Larson. He's had plenty of success at Auto Club Speedway and parlayed that into some success at Michigan. So if Auto Club Speedway isn't a track that should be used as a comparison point, what are some of the tracks that you have looked at that you think reflect at least certain components that could play a role in the racing we're going to see this weekend?
So I think number one would be New Texas. because it is kind of a super momentum track. Your on throttle time in the corners early in runs is pretty much 100%, very little brake usage. And I think that the new Texas is probably the best place to at least look and try to find some similarities. Next would probably be Vegas, just because there's not a lot of tire wear. You know, I know it is a mile and a half, but you have more off throttle time in Vegas. I just can't, Kansas is actually, that track has had a little bit more tire wear, and you can run multiple grooves more at Kansas. I'm slowly really starting to like the tire wear that you see at Kansas and the multiple grooves. And Charlotte, you know, I can see why at Charlotte, but I'm still not sold. I think it races a little bit more like Kansas than it does, or I think Charlotte races more like Kansas than it does, you know, this week at Michigan. So I think that there's a lot of unknowns going into this week. Surprise, we have a new car this year. So don't get too wrapped up in these comparisons. I'm going to go over what I think is going to be valuable here moving forward, but I am not Auto Club, and I would say Texas, the new Texas, would be my number one.
Yeah, just a little bit of track history here as well. Over the last two races at the Brooklyn Tri-Oval, there have been just two cautions for multi-car accidents, and just once in the last five events has a winner started from outside the top three. As we're mentioned, different car, a lot more unknown commodity, so I don't want to put too much stock in all of that. Just felt it was fascinating when we talk about it, because inevitably we're going to see cautions at such high speeds for cars that spin out, or one car wrecks potentially that are out there. And when you look at the recent winners, as the series has run here two times a year, or at least did up through 2020, Ryan Blaney victorious, grabbing the checkered flag last season, and it was the Kevin Harvick show three straight races before that. Joey Logano slid in there as well, and Kevin Harvick the year before that. Kyle Larson, if you go back to 2016 and 17, did win three straight at this track. And as far as manufacturers are concerned, Ford has been the dominant manufacturer, while Toyota has actually struggled to get the checkered flag, despite having some very strong finishes here. Interesting note from Bob Pockrass earlier. I don't think it applies to handicapping at all, but felt the need to share it. No driver has actually won their first race of the season in Michigan. Obviously not predictive, but an entertaining tidbit that you can win to use a bar bet with some of your NASCAR betting friends that are out there. Given all that we don't know about Michigan, before we get into some of the driver breakdowns, Worm, what were some of the variables that you're putting the most weight and emphasis on as you begin to dissect this card?
So I went back and watched the race from last year, and the package is just so different. I didn't finish it. You know, I kind of watched and got a good feel for it. I didn't even finish it because I just don't know how much I'm going to take away. My goal is to not fall in love with anything quite yet. I don't want to force anything. I want to kind of let the week come to me. But with that being said, I do think that there's some value on some guys, and the value I find is in just their recent form. It's the guys that have looked fast. You know, if you want to get into the Ford camp, like, I think Fords are going to be good. But I also think you've seen the Toyota struggle kind of recently, and I expect to see more from them on an oval this week versus some of the tracks that we've had, in the previous 3 or 4 weeks.
Well, that, you know, honestly provides the perfect segue, and we'll get into some of the favorites for this weekend, but we can start in that Ford camp, and we can look at Kevin Harvick, who right now is on the outside looking in. You continue to see his points dwindle in terms of an ability to point himself in, so you have to imagine he's going to need a win over the next four races. And when you look at Harvick's price, widely available at a low of 20-1, upwards of 28-1 in the betting market. He, of course, leads the pack with five career victories at Michigan International Speedway, including the aforementioned three straight in 2019 and 2020. He's notched top 10s in 8 of 11 starts before crashing out of the Indy race that you talked about at the top of the show with Alex Bowman. But the thing about the four car, and we're going to sound like a broken record, he gets the most out of his equipment. But Worm, I was blown away. I know it's been a struggle for him this year. He's led just 13 laps all season long.
I mean, what a far cry from 2020. I mean, this is... It's kind of crazy. Just, I think that right now, I think SHR just doesn't have kind of that straight line speed that you need on these aero sensitive tracks. And, you know, when Kevin Harvick, he looked really good at Loudon, and he's raced well on some road courses. But that was never early in a run. It was always late in a run. And if you lose a little momentum or you have a poor restart at a track like Michigan, you drop like a rock. I mean, Kurt Busch, you know, started, he slipped up, or I can't remember who got into him last year at Michigan. He dropped to like 22nd when he was running third because he lost all of that momentum. And if Harvick is a little slow on that restart or is struggling just in general on restarts, it's going to be really, really hard to get up there and race for a win.
And, you know, we talk about the four, you know, having speed when you unload at the track is one thing. I'm interested to see if he doesn't show it in practice, if he's able to make adjustments to his car, because at this point, it's not about racing for points. It's doing everything you can to try and get that first victory of the season. Another Ford driver trying to get a first victory of the season, but obviously in a much better place as far as his postseason prospects are concerned, is Ryan Blaney. And when you look at Ryan Blaney's price this weekend, I mean, Blaney finds himself with slightly shorter odds than Harvick, anywhere from that 10 to 1 on the low end upwards of 15 to 1. We've talked about the pressure. You gave credit to his crew chief and team for some of the strategy they employed, electing to forego tires. He did win here last year, but in my opinion, yes, he had a top 5 car, but I didn't think he was anything close to the best driver, and the driver rating further supported that.
No, I agree. Here's the thing. I think that this is a track that Blaney has to really be excited for, because it is about just raw speed. And when you're looking for raw speed, Blaney can give that to you. Where Blaney tends to struggle is, like we've said, back in practice. So I'm not rushing to find maybe a matchup or two on him. I know that he has a few matchups, and I don't see an edge on either of those. But I will say this. I think that you could see him run top three all day. I think that that's a legitimate possibility. Will he have the best car? Who knows? But if, you know, on a late race restart, if you've got Blaney out there and he's in the right lane, which I think will be the top, you could see him up there mix it up for the win. So I like his, you know, win or top three price a lot more than his matchup prices.
And you know what? That was kind of the sentiments that you offered up last week at Indy. You said he wasn't a driver that you wanted to focus on in some of his head-to-head matchups. You thought he had boom or bust potential. And he showed for stretches in that race that he had a car capable of doing some damage. Unfortunately, wasn't able to get there. And to your point, Tyler Reddick was the best car, who did grab the checkered flag. From the drivers in the Ford camp, when we start to look at the favorites and familiar faces here, as always, Chase Elliott, you know, upwards of that 6, 6.5 to 1 range. Saw his string of 5 straight top 2 snapped after he was basically punted on the overtime restart. Hasn't been great on the 1.5 mile track comps that you mentioned earlier, like this season. Finished 9th at Vegas, 29th at Kansas, 33rd at Charlotte, but he wasn't in the same form that we're seeing now. What is interesting, though, about the 9, when you try and figure out his history at Michigan, doesn't have a single top 5 in his last 5 trips here, but he has been 9th or better in 10 of 11 starts. And his average finish just inside the top 8 is actually the best of all active drivers in the series. He's led 144 laps at Michigan International Speedway, and 3 times he's finished as runner-up. How do you begin to assess handicapping the 9, and what kind of expectations you have for him on Sunday?
Well, pretty much like I do every week, I think he will look average to below average in practice. He will qualify slightly better than I thought he would in practice. You know, based on practice, I don't think he would qualify very well. You probably see him qualify 6th or 7th, even though he was probably 16th on the board in practice. And then with like 30 to go, he'll be in the best position to win. And I don't know how. I just think that team is right now a championship team. But is it too soon? You know, and right now they're getting great finishes, but they haven't had fast cars, and you need fast cars when it comes down to these playoffs. But the team right now is definitely operating on all cylinders, from just the setups and the adjustments that they make on the car to Chase running good, clean races, and their strategy has been great all year. So I think he's probably properly priced, you know, but like I said, I don't think there's an edge either way. Whenever I say someone's properly priced, I just don't. I wouldn't be shocked if they were a little better, and I wouldn't be shocked if they were a little worse than their price. So at this point, it's just kind of sit back and watch the week unfold when it comes to Chase.
A man who should be mentioned in the same breath as Chase, who could be some of his biggest competition on race day, that, of course, the 18 of Kyle Busch. The Mercurial driver has struggled of late, had some pretty poignant comments, in my opinion, in a great feature article that you can see on NASCAR.com. Kyle talking about some of the challenges that this season has provided, the balancing act of being a full-time race car driver, racing dad, as his son is continuing to get into all of that, as much as trying to identify what racing team he could be a part of for 2023. When you look at the 18, he has 9 straight top 10s and laps led in 7 races, 7 of those 10 races at Michigan. Hasn't won here, though, at the Irish Hill since 2011. Why is that year important? Because that was actually the final season before there was a repave in 2012. He was open and honest, said he struggled with the initial repave, but as the track has continued to weather, it's felt much better. And as what you've seen over his last 5 trips to Michigan, he's had an average finish just outside the top 5. But when you look at the current form, now 7 straight races without a top 10 since he finished 2nd at Gateway. His lone victory this year came at Bristol, and anybody who watched that race realized he wasn't the best car. It was Chase Briscoe and Tyler Reddick parting the Red Seas, allowing the 18 to get there. And one of Kyle's quotes this week leading up to the race said, "We've messed up a little bit with some strategy calls, and I've messed up spinning out in a couple of races and things like that, just trying hard to get positions. And so, you know, we should have better results than we do. The optics don't quite look as good because the results don't say it, but the performance has been there on our side, so we just need to have some more good results." When you look at comparable mile and a half tracks, average finish of 3rd, 4th at Vegas, 3rd at Kansas, 2nd at Charlotte, and you can make the case that Vegas, he should have won, was done in by a late strategy call, and it may be one of his most impressive drives of the season, finishing 2nd at Charlotte with a banged up race car. When you're assessing the 18, we know it's been tough to peg him, especially pre-week, but how do you look at handicapping Kyle Busch?
This one, I was kind of, I was bummed to see this 7-1 price. I was hoping to get like a, maybe a 12-1 just because his current form's been so poor. But these tracks, you know, they're not like Michigan. In fact, I don't think there's many like Michigan at all. So I think it's really tough to pull track comparisons. But on those mile and a halfs where you have to have speed, where it's been tough to pass, where you have to work, your car has to work on both the top and the bottom in order to make a pass, Kyle's been able to do it as good as anybody. So I was kind of hoping to see a little bit more of an inflated price on him. And when he opened at 7, I kind of thought that the books got it right. But I don't think that current form for Kyle is what you're going to get this weekend. I expected to see him, you know, kind of run in the top 5 and mix it up all day. You know, last year, 2 tires didn't work. I mean, you needed to have 4 tires, and the guys that took 4 tires and took care of their stuff were great over long runs. And I think you're going to need that at Michigan when you have a wide track where guys can give each other room. And I think that the track aging does lend Kyle to be a potential threat to win this race. I just would like to see him a little bit higher than that 7-1 price. If he looks good in practice and qualifies well, I'd be happy to jump on him at 5.5 or 6-1 and not feel bad about giving up this 7-1 price at this point in the week.
Makes sense. Knowing what kind of car or machine he's going to have underneath him, being willing to take a shorter price rather than doing some of the guesswork on a pre-week with a smaller speculative bet definitely is music to my ears as well. When you're talking about one Kyle, it would be remiss to not mention the other Kyle, and that, of course, Kyle Larson, who qualified on the pole here last year, led 70 laps. We know he's got great track history at Michigan and 2-mile ovals in general. Continues to search, though, for feel on the new car. Odd situation, in my opinion, last week is the team came out and said there was no brake failure on his collision with the 42. He said he wasn't able to engage the pedal. I'm sure there was a nice, you know, kumbaya moment that they had at the Hendrick shop to try and figure all of that out. To the 5's credit, he still has 9 top 5's this year, which put him 2nd only to Ross Chastain in this category. 3 top 5's in his last 6 starts, better than a 5th place average finish on the comparable tracks. Figuring out the 5 for me has been damn near impossible. I'm hoping you should shed some light on it.
Well, I can't. I mean, the way that the five I anticipate this week, he'll look good in practice. He'll probably be, you know, in the top 5 speeds, if not 1 or 2 when it comes to practice speeds on the one lap. I expect him to qualify in the top 5, and I expect him to look really good early in the race. Where he's struggled this year is I don't think the adjustments have been as good as they've been in the past, or other teams are adjusting maybe a little better than he is, because he tends to disappear later in races, and it's the opposite of what you've seen from him in the past. I don't know what's missing right now on the 5 team, but there's just something that's not quite off, and whatever it is, the 9 team is taking advantage of it. They aren't looking that fast in practice. They aren't qualifying as well as Kyle, but they are mixing it up and they have the best car late in the race. So I'm kind of shocked that they're both in that Hendrick camp, and they are kind of opposite of each other, kind of the yin and the yang. But right now you just want to be in a position to win a race, and Larson just hasn't done that at all this year. He was very fortunate to win at Fontana, but I just think he's properly priced. Until he shows me something, I am not going to get involved with Kyle Larson.
Yeah, and it makes a ton of sense. I mean, I looked at his matchup prices last week at Indianapolis and felt he could have a breakthrough performance. Was stunned to see him in that plus 130, plus 140 against a lot of comparable drivers. Thankfully, discretion was the better part of valor, did not make the dance card. And as we saw when he wrecked with Ty Dillon, would not have been able to cash any of those particular matchups that he was involved in. Another driver that's shown a lot of speed on mile and a half tracks would be the 11 of Denny Hamlin. He hasn't won at Michigan since 2011, but he's been sixth or better in four straight trips to this particular track. When you look at Hamlin, he's crossed the finish line first in two straight races on non-drafting tracks a mile and a half or longer. Unfortunately for him, the win at Pocono doesn't count as an actual win, and he was fourth the race before that. For all the trials and tribulations and the interesting season that the 11 has had, he has shown speed on comparable tracks. How do you assess Denny this weekend at Michigan?
Again, I think the books got this one right. Denny was great at Texas in the All-Star race, and I don't want to refer to that, you know, a little bit different package and format, but he showed speed at a place that's going to, you know, be a high momentum track, and I was also hoping to see him a little higher. I didn't think you'd see him as high as Kyle at like that, what I thought could be a 12 or 13 to 1 and maybe take some value, but I expected him to be around 10 to 1, and, you know, to see him kind of right around that 7 to 8 to 1 mark, like I said, I think he's going to be good, but I'd rather just take a look in practice, and because someone out of these group of drivers, and it could very well be Kyle Larson, it could be Denny, it could be Kyle Busch as well, someone's going to look the best, and I'd rather wait on a little bit lower price knowing that that they have the best car underneath them.
Yeah, being able to go in a battle with a car that warranted the favorite price tag, because to your point, some of these drivers could drift. You could see prices open up in the same range, and you just want to feel confident that you know they're going to have machines that are capable of winning a race on the 2 mile tri-oval this weekend. Obviously, we've covered the favorites. We've mentioned some of the Ford camp. We didn't talk about any of the track house drivers or a couple other notables this weekend. So I want to give you the opportunity, if there were certain drivers you wanted to highlight, whether it was a Tyler Reddick, a Martin Truex Jr., or anybody else that you've had your eye on from an interesting pricing standpoint, not necessarily obviously endorsing a bet by any stretch of the imagination, but just some names for our listeners to keep tabs on before practice.
Well, I'm interested just to see how Ford unloads. I think as a whole, I expect them to be good, but I'm not quite sure. I'm just not quite sure on them. I actually was a little bit more, I've been a little higher on the Toyotas, and Chevys have just been so solid. You know, if you want to take a look at Tyler Reddick, I would have nobody or would have no argument if someone would say, hey, I'm interested in betting Tyler Reddick. I'd be like, hey, I don't blame you. The guy can race his race car. However, the one thing that Tyler Reddick will do, and we've talked about this before, he'll disappear sometimes. And you definitely don't want to be in a position where you have some money tied up in an investment in Tyler Reddick this early in the week. And it's one of those weeks where he's running like 12th. You know, you want to make sure that he's got a fast race car, because if there's anything that Tyler Reddick is he is predictable. If he looks good in practice, he's going to be good in the race. When it comes to a guy like Martin Truex Jr., he's almost the opposite. He doesn't really look good in practice, but he kind of learns throughout the race, and he finds himself running kind of in this, you know, maybe 5th to 10th place often. So, you know, I kind of expect Martin to be average in practice and qualifying, but I expect him to race better than both of those outcomes. So right now, like I said, this track is just so different, and I'm trying not to get too involved, or, you know, I guess create these biases that, you know, I'm eventually going to have. I want to make sure that I'm very objective when I approach this practice and qualifying, and make sure that we have our money in good.
No, it's smart. Makes a ton of sense. Come in with a baseline for handicapping and some expectations. See what gets confirmed once cars get on the track and be able to make more informed decisions once some of those head-to-head matchups markets open up and there's a lot more liquidity there with a chance to take advantage on Saturday night into Sunday morning. And of course, as we always do around here, we share those race day best bets with you. We tweet them out from our various accounts and you should be following at BetTheBoardPod. You can check out the Bet the Board website for that information. It's right there in the top of the post. Should you want to go back and revisit the podcast, we encourage you to do so in case you missed any nuggets when you listen for the first time on Friday, but it'll also be accompanied by a best bet. And as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, Worm, those numbers move quickly. So you want to make sure you have the Twitter alerts queued up and you get those bets in as soon as possible. That's my long-winded way of setting up the best bet portion of the program. And each and every week we tell all of you guys what we offer up on the podcast. It's a smaller position than what we'll do on race day, but it's still a bet worth making, one that we're invested in as well. So as it pertains to Michigan this weekend, Worm, where are you seeing a pre-week opportunity?
I'm seeing a pre-week opportunity with a guy we haven't even talked about tonight. And this is just going on talent, in my opinion, and kind of current form. I'm never shocked at this driver out there leading laps, and I'm always shocked at how young he looks. That's right. I'm talking about Chris Bell. I think.
I thought you were making a case for Ty Gibbs here. He's filling in the 45 again, so I got confused for a second.
No, oh, man. Could you imagine if I like laid everything against him last week and then I turn around and he's my pick this week? No, not going to do that. Definitely going with Chris Bell this week. You know, he's 15-1. I expect him to qualify well. And like I said, this guy's got a ton of talent and I expect him to be mixing it up there in the front. So I love the price that we're getting on this guy at top five price of 2-1, pretty much readily available. And so I would say at this point for me, the best bet of the week is Chris Bell top five at 2-1.
Can I ask you the hardest question that I've probably asked you this entire podcast? I'm going to put you on the spot because you had no idea I was going to ask it.
Bring it.
If you had to buy stock in one of two young drivers right now, you could only pick one. I'm going to give you two options.
Okay.
Tyler Reddick or Christopher Bell going forward?
Ooh. So if I'm just going to think out loud here, I think Chris Bell is a better driver than Tyler Reddick. I think Tyler Reddick is a more mature driver, if that makes sense. So I think that there's more upside with Chris Bell than there is with Tyler Reddick. So I am going to go with Chris Bell, and that might be biased because I made a lot of money on him betting in the Xfinity and trucks. But I would take Chris Bell over Tyler Reddick at this point.
Yeah, the main reason I ask is, of course, these guys will be both drivers for Toyota maybe as soon as 2023. Obviously, Reddick's contract with 2311 Racing doesn't start till 2024, but I have to imagine there may be some interesting movement between now and the Daytona 500 to kick off the 2023 season, so we'll keep tabs. But there's no doubt we've seen a youth movement. We've seen a lot of talent from some of these younger drivers that are pushing the old guys, and it makes for a very competitive field each and every Sunday throughout the course of the season. We'll see if the youth movement is served as we get into higher stakes racing and the postseason that's right around the corner. Thanks to everybody for tuning in as always for another edition of the Stay Green podcast. I want to encourage all of you to follow Chris on Twitter. That's at ChrisWormy15. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. And as always, Worm, I give you an opportunity for the final word. Anything you want to get across? I know if we're talking about NASCAR and home tracks, this weekend is it for you being the Michigan native.
This would be my home track. Yep, I grew up in just outside of Kalamazoo, and I think I've been to the track twice. I think Biffle, the last time I was there, Greg Biffle won. I think Johnson like blew a tire with like 10 to go or something like that, and I think Biffle ended up winning. I know I had a crumb on him, so I was able to walk away with a little money in my pocket. But I think that was Biffle. It might have been his last win was at Michigan. So I wish, you know, here's the deal. Repaved tracks I've always struggled with, but I was really excited when I came back and I watched the race from last year and I saw four tires benefit, you know, on a longer run versus two tires. So I think you'll see tires be important in this race, and those are the kind of races I like that you kind of have that predictability on ovals. So I'm looking forward to this week, and I'm hoping we can get some multiple groove racing.
For all those folks out there that are playing along with our Stay Green bingo cards, you can now use your space on a Greg Biffle mentioned something I didn't anticipate when we started recording about an hour ago. Want to wish all of you, the loyal audience, the best of luck this weekend with wherever your racing car takes you. And with a top five ticket on Christopher Bell in hand Sunday afternoon from the Irish Hills in Michigan, hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Cheers.